1963?
Oh, I'm having the best time! Is that a monster?
There's no such thing as monsters, it's just creatures you haven't met yet.
I have the whole universe at my fingertips.
So I'd love it if you came with me.
Doctor Who, the brand new season. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Now on Radio 4, another chance to hear Robin Ince's Reality Tunnel, first aired in 2023. And today, Robin talks about love, books, and his love of books.
Robin Ince's Reality Tunnel. Introduction.
I'll tell you one thing that makes me happy. Finding the beauty.
Finding the love.
That's what I find in libraries and bookshops. Talking to strangers.
Sharing the things that we find beautiful.
This show's predominantly going to be about love.
We loved it. Yes, I loved it as well. It's very, very moving.
One of the things that books are is they're weapons of empathy. Ideas from our mind on a page. They give us permission to be ourselves. They give us permission to understand other people as well.
Otherness.
A fossil of the mind. Of the mind. So that's kind of what this one's going to be about.
Oh, right. Well, let's get started then.
I now spend so much time in libraries and bookshops that I am frequently mistaken for someone who actually works in the bookshop. Right? And I love this. I was in a bookshop in Gerrard's Cross and I was just hanging around the shop and this woman rushed in. She went, excuse me, sorry, I'm in a bit of a hurry, but I need to find a Paddington book for my five-year-old granddaughter who lives in Perth, Australia. I said, that's fine, come over here. I know where they are. And I said, I think this one will be good for your granddaughter because there's lots of kind of scenes of different parts of the UK and when you talk to her, you can talk about that. She went, whoa, that's absolutely fantastic, first go. Oh, that is good. I've not seen you here before. When did you start working here? I said, I don't work here. She said, what are you doing here then? I said, well, I was just talking about a book that I've written. She went, you've written a book? What's it about? I said, well, some of it's about the nature of time. She went, oh, I saw a documentary about that. That's very interesting. I'm going to buy your book too. Which is a very slow way of getting a bestseller.
Chapter 1.
I want to tell you about this cannibal book, actually. I've got some of my favourite kind of books here, ones that I picked up. And I was in a wonderful bookshop in Sedbergh, and there was a woman looking in the death section. And she went, oh, I just can't find what I'm after. I said, what kind of book are you after? She said, well, I'm really after a book about all the different traditions of how people behave in different cultures around death. I said, well, what you want there, I think, is that book by Caitlin Doughty. And she picked up and she went, well, that's absolutely wonderful. That's exactly what I need. And then she said, I don't suppose you know where the cannibal section is, do you? I said, yes, the cannibal books are just over there to the left. I imagine you've already got Ray Tannehill's book on cannibalism. She said, yes. How did you know? I said, because anyone with a passing interest in cannibalism will always start with that book. She went, you're very wise. I'm glad you work here. I said, I don't. She said, why are you here? Anyway, I sold another copy. And if I keep working at it, if I knew every shop in the UK, that's 416 books sold. So this is a great pan book that I picked up, and I just love this. The Last Cannibals, and it's got one of those kind of covers that just says, come in, come in, the world is lurid. And on the back, it just has this picture. It goes, she's a charmer, but she's a cannibal. Oh, not again. How unlucky I am on Tinder. This is what I wanted to talk about today, was the love and the joy that can be found, not merely in books, but also in the world, because I think sometimes we're so shy of talking about love. And one of the things that I loved when I made the last couple of episodes of this was some of the feedback that I got. I got a lovely thing from a 63-year-old man who listened to the show and afterwards said, I have spent my whole life believing there's something wrong with my mind, just the way that it kind of jitters around from subject to subject and the chaos of it. But I've just listened to your show and I've realised I'm not the only one. There might be many of us, and if there aren't many of us, there are two of us, right? And I love that. There was someone who regularly comes to my gigs, brought along her dad. Her dad was a retired bricklayer and came up to me afterwards and just looked me right in the eye, said, can I just tell you, I did not understand a word of that, and I've had a lovely time. And the scariest bit of the last series was when my dad listened to it, because you can talk to strangers, sometimes in the most honest way. But when you're with your family, you put the old mask back on. And my dad was going to go to bed at 10. I was staying with my dad. And they went, oh, do you know what? It's nearly time for your show. And he said, oh, I'm going to sit up and listen. And even then, as a 53-year-old, the agony of thinking, my dad's going to hear the real voice that's inside my head. What's he going to think? Oh, dear, the child, is it too late for adoption? You know, and... Unfortunately, he did like it. And there's something now that I'm going to tell you is that I don't have to be scared of that now. And I wish I was scared of that, because since the last series, my dad has died. And that's why I want to talk about love.
Chapter 2.
The importance of books when I was growing up, like, one of the things is, because I was a bit of an outsider kid, one of those kids that didn't really feel that they fitted in, I used to think, oh, I'm not like a proper boy, I want to be a proper boy. So I ended up buying Match Football magazine and a Panini sticker book to try and be more like a boy, but it didn't work out. By the end of the week, I was dressing as Serverland from Blake 7 again. Anyway, so... Like, I have a book here, a very special book, The Goodies, right? I've got The Goodies file here. And that was the excitement for those of us who would think, nothing's really for me, and you'd always kind of sit in the corner of the playground retreating into a book. But then The Goodies would be on TV. And this book of The Goodies that I've got here is The Goodies file. Some of you will remember, of course, oh, show me a home where the buffalo roam, and I'll show you a house with a very messy carpet. And this is a copy of The Goodies file that's very special to me, because this one is signed by all three of the Goodies. And this is the beautiful thing about writing and love. When I did a gig with The Goodies, which was a lot of fun, I'd worked with Graham, Tim and Bill separately before, but I'd never worked with all three of them together. We did this 50th anniversary Goodies gig down in Bristol at the Slapstick Festival, and all of the public had voted for their favourite Goodies episode that then The Goodies would watch with an audience. And something that was rather beautiful and wonderful was the public had voted for an episode that all three of them think is rubbish. And so it meant that an audience of 500 watched while they could very clearly hear Bill Oddie repeatedly saying, well, this hasn't aged very well, has it? But I was scared to go up to The Goodies, right? Here I suddenly was at 51 years old, and I thought, why have I never asked them to sign my book? Because that bit of sometimes telling people that you love something they do is more embarrassing than going, excuse me, mate, I saw that thing on the telly the other day. It was rubbish. The worst hour of my life. Because that's the interesting thing. We're scared of expressing love. To share a positive thing often means that even if we are going to be positive, we have to be tremendously negative first of all. Like, I was doing a gig in Tunbridge, and the guy who ran the bookshop said, oh, just so you know, there's a woman called Sally who's going to come along. She's about 86, and she's usually got an opinion, so I hope you enjoy it, right? So I did the gig, and then afterwards she came up to me, and she went, I waited till last to have a word with you because I wanted to say something. And I just need to tell you, first of all, I did not want to come tonight. My friend said, that man from Radio 4 is coming to our local theatre. Why don't you come along? Well, I had a look at the description. I went, that is not my cup of tea at all. But anyway, they bought me a ticket, which was rather annoying because it meant that I couldn't say no. And then I got here and thought, what an awful theatre. The wine is absolutely terrible. It really is. I haven't touched it. Smelled disgusting. Anyway, so I finally got in and I sat down in those chairs. Now, you were lucky, you were standing on stage, you don't have to sit in those awful chairs. That's like something out of the Spanish Inquisition. There was a little spike sticking in my coccyx nearly all of the way through, absolutely agonising. So I was there thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to be here for 2.5 hours sitting in an agonising chair watching some awful man that I have no interest in. And then you walked on stage and I thought, well, he doesn't look like I thought he would look. So, oh my God, what am I trapped with? But actually, I've had an absolutely lovely evening.
Chapter 3.
Because with my dad, that was one of the things is, because we didn't actually say out loud, I love you, but we did it through books. Like, in the last few years of his life, he couldn't really get out very much. In fact, the last time he came out was to a book event that I did in Chorley Wood. And he sat in the front row, and I remembered why I didn't like him coming to my gigs. Because the bookseller began with a lovely little speech. She went, and of course, Robin has recently won Author of the Year from the Bookseller Association. And my dad said, I don't know why. And... And I know why he did that. He did that because, as much as I knew that he loved me and he was excited about that thing, that embarrassment of saying, oh dear, I've just said, well done, son, and I shouldn't have done, but you know, that kind of thing, that was all it was. And so what we would do is everywhere that I would go, I would always find a book for him. That was how we would communicate. I would find a book. I was in Carlisle, a wonderful bookshop called Bookends. And every single day there would be a reason to ring my dad. And I would say, ah, Dad, I was just in Bookends in Carlisle, a lovely secondhand bookshop, you'd like it. I found a book about the great actor Robert Donat, who of course we're both fans of, and I thought you might quite enjoy this book. Oh, that sounds interesting. It's got some wonderful things in it, really wonderful stories as well about his later career. Yes, yes, I don't think I've got it. I'm pretty certain you haven't got it either. Oh, good, good, good. Okay then, would you like me to pick it up? Well, yes, I would. Thank you very much for thinking about me. And then 5 days later, the first place I'd go when I'd finished the tour for that week is I'd go back to my dad's house and I'd say, hello, father. And he'd go, hello, son. Because we would always return to 1946 in those times. These powdered eggs are catching in my teeth. Yes, father, I do apologise. But I found this book. Do you remember the book about Robert Donat? Oh, yes, the book about Robert Donat you mentioned. Yes, well, this looks like a very interesting book. Yes, I hope it is a very interesting book. It has rather a good picture of Ingrid Bergman. That is a very good picture of Ingrid Bergman, actually. I'm glad you got that book for me. And a book about the Cotswolds as well. Yes, I thought you'd like a book about the Cotswolds. Yes, that looks very interesting as well. Would you like some tea and cake? Yes, I would. Thank you. Thank you for thinking of me. And what was really going on all that time was I was saying, I love you. And he was saying back, I love you. For some people, you don't have to say love. That was how I bonded with my dad. We went to wonderful places. We used to go to this bookshop called the Penn Cottage Bookshop. It's actually what Terry Pratchett's L Space is based on, a visit he had to the cottage bookshop. It was a bookshop that was just a cottage filled with books. And I would go there with my dad, and there was this place of wonder, book after book after book. And then there was a special attic. In this special attic, only the most trusted customers were allowed. There was a lock on the door you would be allowed in. Here were the most expensive books, £2, £3, £4. And my dad would be allowed in and I would go in with him. I couldn't believe it, 8 years old, and I was allowed into the secret space. And then I remember years later, at the age of 15, going back with my dad, and it turned out the attic was no longer available for anyone. And my dad said to the old man who ran it, he said, is the attic not available anymore? He said, no, I'm afraid not. You see, the problem is I'm getting older, and I've now realized that the distance between the counter and the door is a little bit too great for me to always hear people knocking when they want to get out. And I realized that when I found out that all the vases in that room were filled with urine. So that's entirely true, by the way.
Chapter 4.
After the goodies, I was a huge fan of horror films. I never saw them, but I had a book with pictures, and it was called Horror Movies by Alan Frank, and it had the most wonderful pictures of Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi and Peter Cushing, Dwight Fry, and there was Frankenstein, and there was The Wicker Man, and there in colour was a film called The Frozen Dead, which was all about some Nazis that had been cryogenically frozen so they could then be reawakened to destroy the swinging 60s. And I would look at those, and I knew I would never get the chance to see those films at that point, and I would think, oh my goodness, what is that film like? And I would make that film in my head over and over again, and then 25 years later, finally, I found it in a DVD shop, and I thought, at last, I'm going to see The Frozen Dead. And what, of course, I immediately found out was that the budget I had in my head was a lot bigger than the budget they had available, right? But that delight, that joy, again, what horror films gave me, like Blake 7, like Doctor Who, like The Goodies, was otherness of people. You know, we are able to walk in other people's minds, in other people's shoes, like Peter Cushing. And I would read about Peter Cushing, these incredible stories, the fact that when Peter Cushing was a child, his mother would punish him by pretending to be dead. Terrifying is that, right? He said in an interview, he said, if I was naughty, and I often was, then my mother would start to sing a song. The song would go, I'm going to go away, away. I'm going across the sea. I'm going to go away, away. And I'd say, oh, please, Mummy, don't die. I promise to be good. But of course, then I'd be naughty again. And Mother would just sit in the chair, being very, very dead. I'd get very upset. And my brother would come in and go, don't be so silly, Peter. You know she's not dead. Go on, kick her, shove her. Because I couldn't, because it was Mummy. And then one day, when she was being particularly dead in the chair, I had a piece of bread covered in jam, and I just shoved it in her face, and she never did it again. So
Chapter 5!
If you can write letters still, that's a beautiful thing. It's like when my dad died, we found lots of letters. And one of the things we found was when I was about 3 years old, I was in a major car accident and my mum was very, very seriously injured and in fact would have died if it hadn't been for my dad insisting that she had to go to a major hospital, not the local hospital. And going through his things, we found that he must have written to the ambulance men who drove that ambulance. Because there's a letter back from the ambulance station which just says, "Dear Mr. Ince, thank you so much. We don't often get letters like this. We are the envy of the ambulance station." And I thought what it was, that here was someone who was dealing with three children and a wife who was severely ill, and he still thought, you know what? I better write to the ambulance men and thank them. Leaving those things behind. Like, I know if I mention ghosts, Brian Cox go, "Ghosts don't exist, they break the second law of thermodynamics," right? He thinks that's a very camp version of him, I think it's accurate. And but ghosts are left behind. People exist inside your mind. Like, this is something that is so unusual in terms of most of the creatures. Every other creature that exists, when it dies, it might leave a skeleton, it might leave an outline, it might eventually even leave a fossil. But we are the only creatures that are able to take ideas from our mind and place them on a page. That is a fossil of the mind. When I pick up a book and I just think, here is some of Carl Sagan, here is some of Jean Rhys, here is some of Ursula K. Le Guin, some of that is still left. This is a lovely book that I have. This is a book called Galaxies and Pulsars. It's quite an old book on galaxies and pulsars, so in many ways it's not scientifically relevant, but I didn't buy it for its scientific relevance. I bought it for the fact it has an inscription in it. It says, "To Mammy, from a quarrelsome and recalcitrant, if not positively contrary offspring, in gratitude for all your efforts before and after and during the 27th of August 1981. If I do not lay the world at your feet, it is because I send you galaxies and quasars with love." Isn't that beautiful? And so I think that, you know, this is why Leave Your Marginalia. And my favourite books are when you find a book and it also has the notes of someone who's read the book. So it's kind of a palimpsest. You're not merely enjoying the thoughts of the author, you're enjoying the thoughts of the reader. I remember reading one, I bought a book by the neuroscientist Colin Blakemore called Mechanics of the Mind, a secondhand copy of his Reith lectures. And I bought this book and some wonderful things happened. First of all, a postcard fell out. A postcard of someone who'd been disappointed by Tunbridge Wells. So that was another mind fossil. And then I saw all of this furious marginalia throughout it of a professor who had clearly read it and disagreed with every single word, right? And they just keep putting exclamation marks. And then at one point they go, "This young man doesn't even understand buttered toast." And then on page 54, he just writes, "I'm going to stop reading now." But at page 57, we found out that was a lie. So I often go to libraries. I love going to libraries. And I have a friend called Richard. When I was visiting Richard's library, there was a lovely story where we were looking at all of the large print Mills and Boone on one wall, and on the other side, there were all of the audiobooks. And then he pointed to one and he went, "Now, that one in particular is very interesting. We had someone ring up the other day." He said, "There's a lovely woman called Lizzie, and she's 93 years old, but she still loves books, but she has to now listen to them. And she rings up every Tuesday," and she rang up on Tuesday and she went, "Richard, I've decided which book I would like this week. I would like you to send round, please, 50 Shades of Grey." He said, "Lizzie, are you sure?" She went, "Yes, I'm sure." He said, "You do know it's quite racy." She went, "Of course I know it's quite racy. I want to know what all the fuss is about. I've lived a life. I don't think much is going to shock me, Richard." And then 4 days later, the phone rings. It is Lizzie. She is furious. She goes, "Richard, CD3 is filthy." He said, "Well, I did warn you." She went, "No, it is filthy. There's marmalade on it or something. It won't play." And I got to a very good bit of sadomasochism. So
Chapter 6.
I'll tell you one thing that makes me happy. Watching Dick Van Dyke singing Chitty Chitty Bang Bang in a diner. Anyway, that makes me happy.
Chapter 7.
I'm an enormous fan of Ernest Thesiger, as I'm sure the rest of you are. If you don't know Ernest Thesiger was in two very classic horror films by James Whale, one called The Old Dark House, the other called The Bride of Frankenstein. He was also a very, very keen embroiderer. He also fought on the Western Front, but he had this wonderful, quite a kind of camp demeanour. He was quite open about his sexuality. And people were always shocked when they found out that he'd fought on the Western Front, because here was this very, very delicate man, something of a dandy. And they go, my goodness, I've just found out. Ernest, you fought on the Western Front. Good Lord. But what on earth was it like? And he would reply, the noise. And this is his book, Adventures in Embroidery. Again, I love that he's left this behind. 5 years it took me to find this book. I eventually found it in a bookshop in Shrewsbury. There's very little marginalia in it, but the one thing that is it turns out it was owned by Enid Pickles. Now, if you wanted a book called Adventures in Embroidery, who would you most want it owned by? Surely Enid Pickles. Because the moment you hear Enid Pickles, you can see Enid Pickles. I have since found the embroidery group in the Shrewsbury area that Enid Pickles belonged to between 1951 and 1972, because that is what the internet is for. And I remember telling my dad about that because he loved old films. And one of the things that I miss already now in the last few weeks since he's not been here is watching Talking Pictures TV with him going, oh, come on, what's his name? He was in that thing. Do you remember there was the thing with the man who, not Dirk Bogart, no, oh, God. You remember there was the milkman in it? Oh, come on, what's his name? Oh, of course, Reginald Beckwith, every single night. And the older I get, the more that I don't want to watch things that involve kind of violence and pain and horror. I want to spend my time reveling in delight and love and wonder. In fact, at the point of middle age, I found that now my favourite shows are celebrity narrowboat shows and 24 hours in A&E, right? Because both of them are absolutely filled with love. If you've never watched 24 Hours in A&E, start off by watching one with an elderly couple, because they are so moving, right? Angela and Harry, they're both in their early 90s, and for some reason that day, Harry decided to try and climb a plum tree. But unfortunately, due to a loose branch, he's fallen. A helicopter's actually come and collected Harry, and they've now taken him all the way to St. Thomas's Hospital, right? And Angela is facing the possible loss of someone that she has loved for decade after decade after decade. But despite that, she has this strange chipperness about her. She has this whole kind of, oh, thank you so much for that cup of tea. That really is an absolute treat to have that cup of tea. Harry doesn't normally bring me a cup of tea at this time of day. I wish he fell out of plum trees more often. I don't, of course, I don't. But I know you're probably busy. You are busy. I hope you find someone that you love. I hope you find a nice man or a woman, because that's the way things are now, isn't it? Anyone and everything, it's all good, isn't it? It's all good. I know you've got to go, but it's just, I'd tell you about the first time that I met Harry, actually. It was during the Second World War. I was 16 years old and he was 18 years old, and we went to a dance. I know it's very naughty, but, well, after the dance, we had a little kiss. You know, it was the war, so why not? And then Harry went back to war, and then 2 years later, he came back from the war, and on that very first day that he was back from the war, he came to our house and he knocked on the door and he asked my father, could he have permission to marry me? And we've not spent a day apart, and every morning when we wake up, we give each other a little kiss, and every night, just before we turn out the light, we give each other a little kiss again. And you just sit there and you go, oh my goodness, this is the most beautiful old couple in the world. Please don't show their voting record. And
Chapter 8.
I mentioned before about Tim Brooke Taylor. And I mentioned about the fact that I did that event, I got Tim to sign the book, and Tim died about 2 months later. And we'd had a fantastic adventure that weekend at the Slapstick Festival. Tim did about 5 or 6 events, and the first event we did together, just him and me, and it was all about At Last the 1948 show that some of you might know, a kind of precursor to Monty Python, is where the Four Yorkshiremen sketch originally comes from. And we decided we'd talk quite a lot about Marty Feldman, a wonderful comic and a brilliant writer. And I said, by the way, have you read Marty Feldman's autobiography? And both he and his wife went, what? Marty's, I don't know he had an autobiography. How do we not know that? I said, oh, I'll tell you why. I said, because it only came out very recently. Because when Marty Feldman died, his wife, Loretta, This goes back again to those fossils of the mind. She found she could look at pictures of Marty and she could look at posters of Marty, but she couldn't look at his writing because the writing had too much of the Martiness of Marty. It was overwhelming. So everything that he wrote was put in her attic. And she said to a friend, I don't want any of this coming down till I've died. I want it all staying up there. But when I'm no longer here, I want you to share these things in as many ways as you want. And so she lived for 30 years more. And then when she died, the friend went up to the attic and found these incredible things. There were sketches, scripts and screenplays. And then there was a cardboard box which said autobiography. It's a beautiful book. It's called I, Marty, E-Y-E. Of course, she had those eyes. And it's filled with love. It's a first draft, I think. And so it's so pure. It's filled with two lots of love. One, his love for comedy. It was such an important thing to him. And the other thing that it's filled with is his love for Loretta. And right at the end of the book, there is an afterword that talks about the day he died, when he just finished filming something called Yellowbeard, and he had a heart attack, and Graham Chapman was trying to keep him alive because Graham Chapman from Monty Python, of course, trained as a doctor. And this is one of the last lines that Graham Chapman ever remembers Marty Feldman saying. He said, please tell Loretta I love you very much, and I'm so happy that I never had to put my thing in anyone else. Isn't that remarkable? Isn't that beautiful? That is totally heartfelt. I love you, Loretta, and I'm thinking, hang on a minute, but I'm also a comedian. It needs to be a little bit of cheek at the end. And I realised that one of the things that I'm very lucky with is that I've got to work with people like Tim. And I decided to write a poem about all of those people who set me on whatever kind of road I've gone on and changed my life. Let me celebrate you now as you stand before me while you can still hear the cheer. Don't let me wait until you're gone to be fond. Don't let fear of embarrassment stifle my delight. How the worry of impending shame leads us to talk about love only when there can be no response. Derision is so easy to dispense, and a brickbat is so easy to receive an acknowledgement of what our self-loathing knew already. We fumble and blush when praised or when praising, waiting to be caught out, rejected. I loved their book. I loved their art. I loved their mind. I loved them. Past tense. It's hard not to fear the present, hard to be present, hard not to bend under a cynical stare, but keep the volume of things unsaid, the regrets of silence, as thin as they can be. Let them take up little space on the shelf in your head. Don't be ashamed of joy. Avoid all that uselessness of regret and indifference. Better to worry that you've overwhelmed than that you've crushed with scorn or silence. And of course, all of this I said in my head as you walk by.
The end.
Thank you very much.
That was nice, wasn't it? Right, enjoyed that. It was written and performed by Robin Ince, produced by Carl Cooper, and was a BBC Studios production for Radio 4. Ta-ra!
And there's more conversation and comedy at 11 tonight when comedian Kathy Burke is back in Radio 4's Bunk Bed talking about self-censorship, Irish accents and boyfriends. That's later tonight, and this weekend Radio 4 is celebrating a comedy hero.
I've always shied away from calling myself a comedian. I prefer to think of myself as a phenomenon.
I'm Max Kinnitt, and I had the great privilege of writing with Rick Mail for over a decade.
Always laughter in the house, different characters, different accents. He just knew Dad was enjoying himself.
During our collaboration, we recorded over 100 hours of conversation, and now, for the first time ever, you can hear some of the never-before-heard highlights.
The Dark Ages actually weren't very dark. They were just badly lit.
Rick Mail and Global Phenomena. This Saturday night at 8 on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
After the news, Ben's